Levine, 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 Levine.
Okay, I think we're set. Must tune the voice. There we go. Let's get the plugs out of the way first for the Phoenix Bookstore, who's got the intelligence to have a lecture series when other bookstores don't even know what that is. Right. I mean, can you imagine this taking place in Crown Books? And KPFK, who will be playing the tape of this on the Roy Tuckman Show. And so forth and so on. After the plugs come the disclaimers. This is not medical advice. I am not a doctor. This is not sexual advice. I am not a therapist. I will not entertain questions about whether or not you should have sex and with whom. Okay. And also a plug for She Who Remembers, who are taping this and tape lots of good lectures for KPFK and other people. So let's have a... what I'm going to talk about tonight is partially out of a book that I wrote 4 years ago called AIDS, Inc., which is now out of print. However, there are diskettes at the counter. And this book will be back in print, hopefully, in 8 weeks. So if you're interested, you can leave your phone number at the counter. They'll call you when they come in. Phoenix has done very well selling these in the past. And they do have diskettes now. Whatever. So the thesis of the book was that they never proved HIV causes AIDS, which was not very well received at the time, and is somewhat better received now, but really we're still operating in a very small corner of possibility. The other thing that I want to talk about and somehow weave this in is what's happening with the FDA these days and alternative health practitioners and dispensers of supplements. The two subjects are somewhat related because they have to do with freedom, and really, I guess if I had to reduce this down to, you know, one sentence, it would be people have the right to choose how they want to take care of their health and who to see and who not to see. So if I want to go into the hospital and have my gallbladder removed and you want to go take 10,000 units of vitamin C every day, there should be no argument there on either side. It's a sort of a philosophy of coexistence. And this is not the attitude of the federal government, unfortunately, or the FDA. Choice in medical care and taking care of your own health in however way you want to do it is not something that you hear political candidates talk about, and they don't even know what's going on in this area. Bush, Perot, Clinton, they haven't the slightest idea that there are millions of people out there who are very upset because the FDA is raiding health food stores, stripping supplements off shelves, going into doctors' offices, taking their Rolodexes, their computer records, their supplements, their equipment, keeping patients for 12, 14 hours rounded up like a herd of animals while they inspect and carry out their warrant at gunpoint with local officers. I'm talking in particular about a raid that happened a couple of weeks ago in Washington to the offices of a doctor there, nutritionally oriented Harvard MD named Jonathan Wright. I spoke with a health practitioner who shall remain nameless today, who was raided on Friday. This person is sort of a combination nutritionist, a psychologist, who only handles referrals from doctors, people who have problems with overeating and alcoholism, does tests, confers with MDs, is doing some research on what she calls digestive physiology. That's her specialty. And thinks that it's interesting that she was busted for practicing medicine without a license and dispensing some compound, which I don't remember the name of, but is a sort of a non-toxic, supposedly, medicine for Candida. Some guy showed up at her office door one day with guns, or with a warrant. Came in, took some stuff. I'm not going to say where it is or who it is. Took records, took research papers out of the file cabinet, private research that had never been published on this subject. It's interesting that Jonathan Wright and another fellow up north named Stephen Levine, who did a lot of research on supplements, including germanium, all these people were sort of independent researchers, all got busted, all ended up in court because of the FDA. This is not the definition of freedom. This is not a good idea. This is very bad stuff. And we also face a similar problem and faced a similar problem in the research on AIDS. Because in 1984, when Robert Gallo got up with his shades on with Margaret Heckler, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and announced that they had found the cause of AIDS, and it was the HIV virus, all research on the cause of AIDS stopped. So there was no more freedom to research if you wanted grant money. That was a settled question. There was no peer review, which is an ordinary kind of thing in medicine. There was no replication of results. There was no questioning of the thesis. There was no nothing. There was only a mad scramble for money to now try to investigate in what sense, how did this virus actually cause a disease? What was the mechanism? So everybody assumed right off the bat that issue was closed. Now this is very unlike what medicine is supposed to be and even has been in the past. And I'm not talking about, you know, alternative medicine, this, and I'm talking about just orthodox, straight down the line medical research. The game has changed. The game has become money, empires built up of researchers who get grants, who support themselves solely by that kind of money, ego, fame, Nobel Prizes, competition, cutthroat. This is very bad, and it doesn't give you the truth necessarily, because there's no check. There are not other scientists around the world who decide that they would like to challenge that finding and say, wait a minute, you know. And the reason that the game is over is now all the grant money starts to pour downhill to Robert Gallo and the National Institutes of Health, and it's all centered around how does HIV cause AIDS. And so, you know, the timeline moves on. Oh, we're not interested anymore in whether it causes AIDS. Everybody's, you know, into how does it cause it. And so if you're still talking about other viruses, other bacteria, other factors, other chemicals, other whatever, you're behind the times. You can publish if you want to, but it'll be a second, third-rate journal. You won't get any research money. And in fact, a doctor in New York named Joe Sonnabend, who was the editor of a journal, respected journal called AIDS Research, got fired in about 83, I think, or 84, actually, soon after the virus was announced, because he decided that the question was still open. And so the publisher took him out to lunch and said, sayonara, Joe. You know, we can't deal with this anymore. We now accept the thesis and, you know, we go on from there, and everything is HIV. So when I wrote this book, there were maybe three scientists that I knew who doubted that HIV caused AIDS. And one of them, Peter Duesberg, was a major cancer researcher at the University of California, Berkeley, still is. And by major, I mean he's one of the fathers of retroviruses, which is the kind of virus that HIV is. The discoverer of cancer oncogenes, every year gets an outstanding researcher grant from National Cancer Institute. He wrote a paper in Cancer of 1987 where he said he couldn't understand how HIV could possibly cause AIDS because it doesn't do anything. It just lies around the body and stunned a lot of people, and then they try to ignore him as quickly as possible. Well, now, these years later, we have a group of 50 scientists who are calling themselves the group to re-examine the HIV hypothesis, who ascribe to the statement that they never proved HIV causes AIDS, and that a truly independent body of people ought to undertake some research to see if this is really a correct thesis or whether we're dealing with something else here. And these are some fairly remarkable scientists, including an infectious disease specialist at Roosevelt Hospital in New York, a couple of emeritus-type professors, one in Scotland named Gordon Stewart, another guy in the United States who used to work for the Mayo Clinic, now retired, a number of people who have come forward and said, there's something very wrong with this. And these are not people who are alternative health people. They're not even arguing that germs don't cause disease, or, you know, they're just saying something is wrong here, badly wrong. So I'm just going to read you a few of these statements here. This is Harvey Bialy, who's the research editor of a journal called Biotechnology in New York City, molecular biologist. The official position of the group is the hypothesis naming HIV as the single etiological agent of AIDS was premature and remains unproved. Bernard Forsher, former biochemist at the Mayo Clinic Emeritus, it seems to me Duisberg asks some important questions that have never been answered. Until those questions have been answered, there isn't any HIV hypothesis any more than the full moon causes insanity. Charles Thomas, former professor at Harvard Medical School, we propose a thorough reappraisal of the existing evidence for and against this HIV hypothesis be conducted by a suitable independent group. Richard Stroman, cell biologist, professor emeritus, University of California at Berkeley. My position on HIV as the cause of AIDS is that after 10 years and perhaps $20 billion, the hypothesis remains at the level of correlation. No cause for AIDS as a complex of diseases has been established. Every paper published on the HIV-AIDS linkage assumes the hypothesis to be the revealed truth. Yet I know of not a single paper demonstrating that HIV kills T cells in human beings. The science being done is good science in its detail, but as science with a capital S, it violates basic principles. The hypothesis is not tested, it is merely assumed. It is science by opinion. Worse, it is bad science, agreed to by leadership which should know better. Nasty. HIV statement by Dr. Michael Lang, infectious disease specialist at St. Luke's Hospital, New York. I think there's definitely an infectious agent at work here. I'm not entirely convinced that it's HIV or that it's one agent. It could be a combination. And then he comments on the 1984 announcement of HIV as the cause of AIDS. I was far from convinced by the data they had then, and I'm still not convinced. We were all forced into a very dogmatic and simplistic view of what caused AIDS. And as far as I'm concerned, from that point on, AIDS research turned into seedy criminal politics, and it remained that way. British epidemiologist Gordon Stewart, now retired, emeritus professor of public health, University of Glasgow. AIDS is multifactorial, brought on by several simultaneous strains on the immune system, drugs, pharmaceutical and recreational, sexually transmitted diseases, multiple viral infections. Peter Duisberg, now cut off from his National Cancer Institute monies after he's taken this new position. Since 1987, I have challenged the virus AIDS hypothesis because HIV is latent and is present in only 1 out of 500 cells during AIDS, and then he goes on to say, and expresses itself, meaning it becomes biologically active, in only 1 out of 10,000 cells. And he says, I've challenged the virus AIDS hypothesis because retroviruses typically do not kill cells, and because AIDS appears on average 10 years after the virus has been neutralized by antibodies. These are T cells. Now, let me just make a couple of quick definitions before we move on. AIDS is basically defined, there are several different definitions, basically defined as a positive AIDS test for HIV plus any one of about 25 indicator diseases, which are presumed to have blossomed because the HIV virus is busy destroying the immune system, which allows these diseases, which ordinarily wouldn't have come to the fore, to come to the fore. And we're talking about a variety of diseases, anything from pneumocystis pneumonia to tuberculosis, Kaposi sarcoma, and eventually at the very bottom of the definition you get down to and other bacterial infections. So with some exceptions, the basic pattern that was set up for AIDS was immune suppression plus opportunistic infection. You could sort of look at it as a big foot mashing down on the immune system, and up here on the other end we have these opportunistic infections that blossom because the immune system, which ordinarily would kill them, doesn't kill them. Unfortunately, that is a very general definition, and we'll see how you run into a tremendous amount of trouble with that kind of pattern of disease, because many things can be fit under that umbrella. Now, if a person tests positive for the HIV virus but has no symptoms, he's said to be HIV positive. What that actually and truthfully means is that antibodies to the HIV virus have been detected in his body. Antibodies are sort of the scouts that the immune system sends out to locate intruders. And the presence of antibodies to a specific microbe means that one has contacted that microbe. That's all that it means, basically. It doesn't mean you're sick. It doesn't mean you're going to die. It doesn't mean you have an illness. The typical understanding of presence of antibodies in the body is actually that the body has mounted a resistance to a germ. That's all that it means. I'm going to take up that in much greater detail later, but I just want to sort of frame that for now. So we have this class of people who are HIV positive, which means they have antibodies to the HIV virus in their body, the trace of a resistance mounted to that germ, but no symptoms. Those people are called HIV positive, but if you read between the lines, and you don't have to read very far, what the medical establishment is basically forwarding is the following. Eventually, this person is going to get sick, he's going to get AIDS, and then he's going to die. So this is, in effect, a death sentence. And someone told me the other day a story about a friend of theirs, HIV positive on a test, freaked, started taking AZT, committed suicide. So let's go on from there. No, I'm not going to take any questions until I'm all through talking, otherwise so we'll get totally scrambled here. There's a thing in the genesis of this thesis about HIV, which is that we have a lot of circular reasoning, sort of assuming what you want to prove. If you begin talking to people from the HIV establishment who are doing the research, you'll hear things like, well, we know HIV causes AIDS. Now, as far as the mechanism by which it actually destroys the immune system, we have some questions about that. But taken together, the evidence is totally overwhelming that it causes AIDS, so that much we know. And at every point, if you start arguing with that thesis, you will find that most of the traditional researchers on HIV have many questions about how HIV could be doing the damage it's doing, many unsolved mysteries, but that just kind of whets their appetite for more research on the mechanism of infection and disease through HIV because they assume that they know that HIV already causes AIDS. But as you can see from the statements of these other researchers, there are people who doubt that a great deal. And in fact, some of these people have said to me this sort of thing. There's a guy named Robert Root Bernstein, who's a professor of physiology at Michigan State. He's been investigating AIDS, reading the literature for some years now. And he says, I can't find a single paper that actually proves that HIV causes AIDS. Another scientist is quoted in a June article in Spin magazine, a very sort of a genius type named Carrie Mullis, who's invented a test for very remote viral particles called PCR. He says, I go lecture, and I meet these top scientists, and I'm meeting some very important ones, and I say to them, listen, you know, I have to talk about AIDS in my lectures frequently, and it would be helpful if I had just some references I could give people on HIV as a cause of AIDS. And they say, what are you talking about? He says, well, I mean, it wasn't my idea that HIV caused AIDS, so, you know, wherever it is in the literature, I'd like to see it. And they say, oh, no problem. As soon as I get back to the office, I'll have, you know, somebody look up the references and send it to you. And he says, I've never gotten a communication from anybody, any of those people that I've ever approached on this, to send me the exact paper that proves that HIV causes AIDS. Now, to prove that a germ causes a disease, if you play the game by the rules of the traditional medical establishment, you must do certain things. You may not like them, and I may not like them. That doesn't matter. These are the rules, and they're called Koch postulates. And they're a way of establishing that a specific germ causes a disease. Now, overriding Koch postulates is if you can cure the disease or you can prevent it, you win the game, hands down. In other words, if you can say anything you want to, you can say, we've established that this germ causes this disease, and if you can cure it or prevent it, nobody's going to argue with you, because that's the ultimate, you know, derivation of your theory, if you can cure it. Obviously, no one's been able to cure AIDS, no one's able to prevent it, so that goes out the window. So the next step down is Koch postulates. In a simplified version, Koch postulates are, you line up some people that have the same disease, and from each one of them you remove the same germ. Now, the question naturally arises, did you remove the right germ? Because people have a lot of germs inside them, and people may have the same germ, and it may not be the cause of the disease. But step one, you remove the same germ from all the people with the disease, and then you take that germ and you inject it in healthy animals. Those animals then develop the disease. You then remove that germ from those animals and say, yeah, that's the germ. That's the germ we took out of these sick humans, and we put it into the healthy animals, and they got the disease. Now, by getting the disease, we mean all the symptoms of the disease. We don't mean you can detect a little infection from the injection you gave them. We mean the disease, okay? So I could stop right here, in a sense, and say, that's it, good night, you know. And they don't talk about it. But in fact, around the world now, there are between 100 and 150 chimps who have been injected with HIV in varying amounts, some as long ago as 10 years, and none of them has AIDS. Two chimps got sick with swollen glands for about 30 weeks when they were first injected. That went away. They haven't had any symptoms since. And the others never got anything. So that's a total failure. If five chimps out of the 100 got the disease, that is nothing to write home about even then. But zero chimps. Now, they can say, well, the chimps are infected with the HIV virus. What does that mean? That means that they can find the virus and remove it, that there may be a piece of tissue that shows a few extra HIV viruses more than they thought would be there, and they can say, well, that's an infection. But it doesn't mean anything. By their rules, they don't have the symptoms of the disease. Now, just the other day, there was an article in the... also, traditionally or typically, you would see a decrease in what they call CD4 killer cells of the immune system. If somebody who had AIDS, none of the chimps have got that either. So, big article trumpeted in the LA Times and the New York Times a few days ago. Scientists at the University of Seattle in Washington have now got 20 pig-tailed macaques that are infected with the HIV virus. And now they're going to go do research for the vaccines and And this is a premier kind of sneak preview of a paper that's supposed to appear in the journal Science on July 3rd. Now, these journals don't like people to leak stories before they come out. In fact, if you leak it too early, they may not even print it. That has happened before. They don't like that. But in this case, it's fairly clear that the people that did the leaking were the people at the National Institutes of Health, who are the people, and I should describe that a little bit, that is the government agency which does disease research in the United States. I mean, they are the premier researchers. They get the heavy government money pouring downhill. And Anthony Fauci, who's one of the biggies in the National Institutes of Health, was there saying, this is a real step forward, and so forth, with these macaques. Well, two things. First of all, none of the macaques are sick. None of them have any symptoms. None of them have the disease. What they're trying to do is desperately to make these Koch postulates come true, and it hasn't happened. Even worse deception is that according to their own rules, you try to start with the species that has the most similarity to humans, which in this case would be the chimps. And as you work away from that, you are less sure of what the hell your results mean. So they don't say, well, look, the truth is, folks, we've got these 150 chimps over here in the closet, and nothing's wrong with them. So we went to the macaques, and there's still nothing wrong with them either. So that's the truth. No, they prefer to say nothing about the chimps and to talk about the fact that the macaques are, quote, infected. Meaningless. Has nothing to do with proving anything. Symptoms are what proves that a disease is being transmitted. It's a green monkey. These are Asian monkeys. Okay, so they don't have Koch postulates, but they've got backup stories. I'm going to go through those backup stories. Transfusion AIDS. Healthy people injected with transfused HIV blood get AIDS. Therefore, HIV causes AIDS. Now, a major researcher named Jay Levy in San Francisco told me this in all seriousness on the phone. I said, how do you know that HIV causes AIDS? He said, what are you, crazy? People get HIV blood, they get AIDS. What else is there to know? That's a kind of a version of Koch's postulate with humans. Not intentional, but you see, you can sort of turn that around and say, we had healthy human beings and we injected them with HIV. We didn't do it on purpose, but they got AIDS. So with that, we know. No. Right. Now, let's start off with this fact from the New England Journal of Medicine 1989 study on transfusion AIDS. 41% of the people in this study who had transfusions of HIV-infected blood died within a year. 50% of those who had been transfused with non-HIV blood died within a year. They didn't say anything about that. Yes, I'll just go over that again, okay? 41% of the people who had transfusions of HIV-infected blood died within a year. 50% of those who had been transfused with non-HIV infected blood died within a year. So, what follows? Nothing. Okay. Now, we also know that blood itself is very immunosuppressive. Just blood, getting blood is immunosuppressive. AIDS is immunosuppression. Plus, blood despite what people will tell you, is not necessarily very clean. There may be a number of microbes of different kinds in blood. So simply by saying, well, we know there was HIV in this blood, does not rule out the fact that there were no other microbes in that blood. So to say that we know it was the HIV in the blood that killed any given person, no proof. No proof. Now, in the years 1987 and 88, according to the American Association of Blood Banks, 29 million Americans received transfusions. Okay. Now, 1978 to 88, I always said, yeah, that 10-year period. There was obviously very ample opportunity during those years to contact HIV in blood, because most of those years the blood wasn't even screened for HIV because no one knew anything about it. Now, during this period of 10 years, 1,466 people were diagnosed with AIDS as a result of transfusions. Okay, that is 0.05% of the people that had transfusions during those 10 years developed AIDS. And somebody is trying to say that we know that HIV causes AIDS because we know that when you inject people with blood that has HIV in it, they get AIDS. And that's the proof that HIV causes AIDS. When what we actually know is 0.05% of the people transfused with blood that could have contained HIV got AIDS. That's what we actually know. That's not proof of anything. And you have to understand now that all of what I'm talking about is not simply, well, but couldn't somebody have gotten AIDS from one of those pints of blood? That's not the question. The question is this proof that HIV causes AIDS? Because this is what we're getting to. Koch's postulates didn't work, so let's try this angle as a proof that HIV causes AIDS. Another argument. They say, well, since blood was screened for HIV, since we've done that in, I think it was 86, somewhere around there, transfusion AIDS has almost disappeared. Therefore, we know, see, since we took the HIV out of the blood and we have no more transfusion AIDS, that therefore HIV was causing the AIDS. Right? Then on the other hand, they say, well, the incubation period for AIDS is anything up to 14 years. So how do they know that transfusion AIDS has almost disappeared? And as a matter of fact, if you want to, you know, get picky about it, since the blood was screened in 1987 and 88, when we're supposedly dealing with clean blood, 1,144 out of 1,466 cases of transfusion AIDS were reported. Of course, we don't know what blood that was and from when, but it certainly doesn't indicate that transfusion AIDS was on the way out. So that's not proof either. Now, there's another brand of argument that's similar to this that has to do with intravenous drug users, hemophiliacs, babies whose mothers had AIDS, that HIV was basically carried through the blood and caused AIDS, and that's how we know that it causes AIDS. But the immunosuppression levels in those groups of people can be explained by non-HIV factors. And remember, what AIDS is immune suppression leading to opportunistic diseases. For example, factor 8, which is the blood fraction that hemophiliacs get, the clotting factor, is extremely immunosuppressive by itself. They also have conditions called hemolytic anemia, blood platelet problems, and so forth, which are very immunosuppressive. And they don't need HIV for that. They've had those problems before there was anything like HIV. Heroin itself is extremely immunosuppressive to some people. Contaminated heroin, of which there are many examples, can be incredibly immunosuppressive to some people. And mothers with immunosuppressive heroin habits that have babies who also happen to be HIV positive can be dealing tremendous amounts of immunosuppression to their babies because they have a heroin habit and they're tremendously immunosuppressed and probably have incredibly bad cases of malnutrition on top of that, as junkies frequently do. So in other words, we don't necessarily need HIV to account for the immunosuppression in those groups. So there is much question there, and it's certainly no proof that HIV causes AIDS. Now I'll go further with that. There are studies which show that in all these risk groups, the AIDS indicator diseases, in other words, the diseases which would make a doctor say, hey, you've got AIDS, if you have an HIV positive test along with it, those indicator diseases, you don't have to have HIV to get them. Therefore, HIV isn't necessarily the cause of those diseases. Okay, now, in a general sense, I'll go through this and then I'll cite some specifics on it. We know that immune suppression can be brought onto all risk groups by factors such as IV drugs, malnutrition, long-term antibiotic use. We're talking about people taking 5-6 pills of penicillin a day for 8 or 9 years because they want to make sure that they don't get a venereal disease, and the doctors say, hey, no problem, I'll write all the scripts you want. Can totally change your body chemistry and has been documented in some AIDS cases in San Francisco who were interviewed by various people. We also know that on a global scale, if you're talking about tremendous numbers, even staying in the United States, sexually transmitted diseases, many incidents of sexually transmitted diseases treated with antibiotics, parasites, tremendous numbers of intestinal parasites, all extremely can be immunosuppressive. And on a global scale, horrible sanitation, starvation, repeated transfusions with unscreened blood, you're talking about serious problems. And in fact, the greatest cause of killing T cells in the world, and T cells are the immune cells that supposedly people with AIDS, you know, the levels go, they're the, you know, immune fighters, part of the immune system. And it has been documented that in AIDS cases, the numbers of T cells go way down. Well, the largest cause of T cell depression in the world is malnutrition, documented. Therefore, it's as if suddenly these researchers discovered immune suppression and said, my God, what is this? Let's look for a virus that causes it. Well, there's all kinds of things that cause immune suppression, and in the very risk groups that people are saying are afflicted with AIDS. Now, all of these specific studies are cited and referenced in Peter Duisberg's February 1991 paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. You can look that up and go look at the references if you want. Here's a study. Hemophiliacs. 6 out of 14 people had severe immune deficiency in one little study. None of them had HIV. Another study. 15 hemophiliacs had immunodeficiency before becoming HIV positive. 2 more studies. HIV observed in only 7 out of 19 and 10 out of 19 hemophiliacs, all of whom had very similar immunodeficiency. So some had immunodeficiency with HIV, some without it, and very similar. 2 other studies show that the degree of immunodeficiency increased in hemophiliacs according to the amount of clotting factor they received, whether or not they were HIV positive or negative. Kaposi sarcoma, which is a discoloring on the body, a major symptom of AIDS, a study showed that 12 HIV-negative gay American men had Kaposi sarcoma. No HIV, and some didn't even have immunodeficiency. IV drug user studies. In a study, they checked into 50 pneumonia deaths. Pneumonia can be one of the obvious symptoms of AIDS. 26 IV drug users who died of pneumonia, no HIV. 24 HIV. Conclusion? Nobody knows. There's no conclusion to be drawn from that. Certainly not that HIV causes AIDS in drug users. Endocarditis, 22 deaths among IV drug users, another possible AIDS indicator disease. 15 of them had no HIV. 16 tuberculosis deaths, which is another frequent AIDS indicator disease, particularly among junkies. 5 of them had no HIV. 28 cases of neurological deficiency in babies of mothers who were drug addicted. 16 of the babies were HIV negative. Begins, you know, wait a minute, what's going on here? You're trying to tell me all these were AIDS babies? Maybe not. A whole bunch of them were HIV negative, had the kind of thing that would make one want to say, oh, that's AIDS, because they have this category of AIDS under dementia, which is sort of presumed to be a neurological condition. Now, here's another interesting study among IV drug users. 21 heroin addicts, only 2 were HIV positive. Now, they followed the ratio of what they call helper to suppressor T cells, which is crucial in AIDS. It was found to decline during a 13-year period from 2, which is normal, to 1, which is supposed to be an indicator of AIDS. But only 2 of them were HIV positive. The main fact is they were all shooting up heroin for 13 years, and probably some of that heroin was contaminated. So we know that all these diseases that are supposed to be indicators of AIDS can occur without HIV, so the obvious conclusion is that it's causative of AIDS. Maybe it's just a marker that indicates that something could be wrong with this person. They may be exposed to a great deal of the blood supply or fluid supply in the society, transfusions, IV drugs, clotting factor for hemophiliacs, body fluids through tremendous number of sexual partners. And if HIV happens to be a germ that's really harmless but is not so easy to catch, then possibly a tremendous amount of experience with the nation's blood and fluid supply is what's necessary to pick up this marker called HIV, which is not causative of disease. That is a real possibility. Now, on top of that, the Centers for Disease Control, if you call them up, which I have many times, and say, listen, you know, pneumocystis pneumonia, I understand, is still the number one indicator of AIDS. Oh, yeah, no problem. Do you guys keep track of people with pneumocystis pneumonia who are not HIV positive? No. So, in other words, is that a little skewed? And in fact, in the book, I devote a chapter to all sorts of reasons that people throughout history have gotten pneumocystis pneumonia. It has nothing to do with HIV. They found a bunch of kids in an orphanage in Eastern Europe after the Second World War, badly malnourished. They all had pneumocystis pneumonia. This is not the first time anybody's ever seen pneumocystis pneumonia. Anything that severely depresses the immune system can bring on an opportunistic infection, of which that is one. The protozoa, or whatever it is, the parasite that causes pneumocystis pneumonia, is in somewhere between 50 to 90% of human beings. It's just there all the time. And so when you are immune suppressed severely enough, it can come to the fore. Another argument. HIV advocates like to say that health workers who've been accidentally stuck with needles have gotten AIDS. Therefore, we know HIV causes AIDS. As far as anybody knows, none of them have gotten AIDS. Maybe one, but it's never been written up, and there's no tracking done to see what else was possibly immunosuppressive about the backgrounds of any of these people. And certainly even one of those out of however many there have been, 20, 13, whatever, would not be proof that HIV causes AIDS anyway. In fact, it would be in a sense counterproof if only one was, you know, had HIV. Or rather, if one had gotten AIDS. Sorry. So what all those people are, or some of them are, those health workers, is HIV positive. They test positive when you do a test, but they have no symptoms. And the disease is symptoms. Now, you could say, okay, but the evidence is so suggestive that HIV causes AIDS. And since we already know it does, this just confirms the whole thing, you know. It's back, I mean, people will tell you that, you know. I mean, look at the whole thing. I mean, you know, HIV causes AIDS, come on. I mean, they know that, everybody knows that. But we don't. Now, some advocates of HIV say that since AIDS is a new disease and since HIV is a new germ, the fact that HIV is found in many AIDS patients is persuasive. But the fact is, and this is something that most people don't understand, that until the 1970s, the technology didn't even exist to find HIV. The reason that they found these retroviruses is because they started developing high-tech equipment in the lab. So HIV could be 6 billion years old. Nobody knows. So it may not be a new germ at all. Tropical diseases, malaria, which many people say actually will give you a positive HIV test, but what's the actual positivity is reacting, it's cross-reacting to the malaria. And there are a number of scientists who have said that that's the case, which could account for the interpolations of huge numbers of HIV-positive people in Africa. Now, there are also HIV advocates who say there are special cases of people who couldn't have died from any other cause but HIV, therefore we know it causes AIDS. You know, look at this person here. We know that they were completely pure, is a sort of, you know, subliminal implication. This is a pure human being. This human being had a blood transfusion. This human being died. This human being is HIV positive, therefore HIV causes AIDS. Now, of course, we don't have the medical records or the backgrounds of any of these people. You know, this is crucial in deciding what causes immunosuppression in people is what they call epidemiology. Let's look at, you know, what's happened. What else could have been immunosuppressive? Sometimes people die and you don't know why it happens. This is a fact of life in the world. There are times when people die and the doctor says, I don't know what happened. One can't discount that either. Now, we do have, apparently, some information about Paul Gann, who's the co-author of Prop 13, you might remember him. He was supposed to have gotten AIDS from a blood transfusion. According to some information that I've read, we also apparently know that he died at 77 years of age. At 70, he had a five-way bypass operation. In 1883, further surgery for blocked intestinal arteries. In 1989, he broke his hip, he got pneumonia, and he died. You know, when you look at it that way, are you still going to say, oh, we know HIV causes AIDS because of Paul Gann? No, you're going to say, And you're certainly not going to say that Paul Gann proves that HIV causes AIDS, which is, remember, what we're talking about here. All this stuff is, how did they prove that HIV causes AIDS? And I'm sort of running down all these possible ways, and they don't check out. Now, HIV advocates claim that they know that HIV is a special kind of virus, and even though it doesn't satisfy Koch's postulates, we know that it kills T cells. It's a special kind of destroyer. It wrecks immune systems, therefore it causes AIDS. We know that it causes T cells in a petri dish in the lab. And as any reputable researcher will tell you, the petri dish has no immune system. Therefore, we have no idea, you know, how powerful this thing is because there's no resistance against it. Now, on top of that, however, the details of how it kills cells, immune cells, are debatable. There is debate about that, a lot of debate. Unfortunately, the people who are debating it are like trains passing in the night in the medical journals because confrontation is not good for grant money. So this is not an argument that's really open to the medical community because the grant money has already been decided. Where the money goes, that's where the researchers go. But if you look at some of the journal articles, you will find there are questions on both sides. In fact, some researchers have said, we know it causes AIDS, we just don't know how. But if suppose they don't know it causes AIDS and they don't know how. Now, for example, on one side of the argument, it's been argued that HIV can only be found in 1 in 10,000 T cells when it expresses itself or becomes biologically active. In other words, when it could cause disease. And T cells replace each other so fast and in such great numbers in the body every day that that's equivalent to a pinprick. The fact that you might have a few possibly infected cells that are killed by HIV. Now, researchers reacted to this charge, which was made by Peter Duisberg, and so some of them switched to macrophages, which is another kind of immune cell. And they said, well, it's not so much the T cells, it's the macrophages. That's what they're killing. But this apparently has a similar problem, or possibly exactly the same problem, namely that HIV just doesn't infect that many macrophages. There are other theories. There are many splendid theories. For example, that it really attacks skin cells, and that triggers a cascade of autoimmune reactions where the body tries to sort of, you know, attack itself. And it's all, you know, it's compelling. It's kind of like, oh my God. You know, it's metaphysical. It's like, this, no wonder we're all dying. You know, we're killing. But, you know, is it for real, is the question. And the orthodox researchers, by their own standards, have to prove the mechanism. They have to establish the mechanism. And they haven't. That autoimmunity thing is up for grabs. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. In fact, some researchers say that HIV is not a type of killing virus to begin with. Duisberg, for example, who I said is one of the fathers of retroviruses, he studied these things for 20 years. Quote, retroviruses typically don't kill cells. On the contrary, they often promote cell growth. Retroviruses have never posed a threat to humans. Harvey Bialy, editor of Biotechnology, HIV retrovirus. There is nothing about this virus that is unique. Everything that has been discovered about HIV has an analog in other retroviruses that don't cause AIDS. HIV only contains a very small piece of genetic information. There is no way it can do all those elaborate things they say it does. Carrie Mullis, a biologist and inventor of this technique called PCR, which is a tool used around the world now, for discovering viral particles in cells where you couldn't see any before. Human beings are full of retroviruses. We don't know if it's hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands. The implication is that we've survived all sorts of viruses like this for a very long time. Some advocates of HIV say, well, we know HIV causes AIDS because we know it's spread through the semen, sexual intercourse, people die, QED. However, a 1991 study in Fertility and Sterility, medical journal, great name, right? I work for Fertility and Sterility. They tested 25 HIV-positive men and could find HIV in the semen of 4. Now, the authors of this article concluded, and I'm quoting now from an article in the June Spin magazine, by Celia Farber, excellent article. Quote, the authors of this article, very little information exists regarding HIV's prevalence in semen and mechanisms underlying its sexual transmission. What? At this point, I repeat my disclaimer on sexual advice. I'm not advising anyone to have promiscuous sex. Forget it. Robert Root Burns, because there are many sexually transmitted diseases. Robert Root Bernstein, a professor of physiology at Michigan State, he's been studying AIDS data for several years, I said, and he says in this article that the whole semen area has lacked peer review and is non-science. And he comments on several studies done between 86 and 88 in which HIV was found in most or all of the semen of HIV volunteers, HIV positive volunteers. He said they discovered 1 to 10 copies of HIV per ejaculate, or 1 copy of the virus per million units of sperm, which isn't enough to spread an infection. HIV is present to that degree in saliva, breast milk, vaginal fluid. And those are not modes of transmission, which is what you'll hear from the CDC or any medical group if you ask them. They'll say, no, they're not. And he goes on and says, you generally need thousands or millions of copies of any virus for it to be infective. Okay, next argument. HIV advocates say, well, there's a high correlation between HIV and AIDS, so therefore, even if there's no causation we can establish, it's very suggestive. But as far as actually finding the HIV virus in people, I don't mean HIV positive, but actually locating the virus, that is not so easy. And figures vary. Some people say they can only find it in 50% of people who have AIDS. Some people say 90%. The figure is booted around. The real correlation is between HIV antibodies and AIDS. Okay? 73% of people with AIDS have HIV antibodies. So I mentioned that this could mean that HIV is simply a marker. But on top of that, finding the virus in people, you ought to know how it's done. It's done with this PCR technique now, which is like, as Celia Farber says in this article, like shining a huge spotlight on these very incredibly tiny particles. And some HIV advocates said, well, we've really wrapped it up now because using this tool we can see that people have HIV in cells. But the problem is first of all, you're only seeing part of an HIV, a particle, but you're seeing particles from hundreds of other viruses in people, retroviruses, when you start to go down to that degree of magnification. So now you've just muddied the waters even more because there are most likely many other viruses that these people have in common when you're tiny a particle level. So when you start to say, well, I'm just going to pull that virus right out of all those AIDS patients and prove it to you, it's not that way. It doesn't work that way. It's said that in the case of one health worker, where Gallo, Robert Gallo, who's the, quote, co-discoverer of AIDS, he said, I'm going to find that virus in that guy and show you. Well, by this very elaborate laboratory technique, which I believe was before PCR, where you had to, like, take cells out of a human and really goose the hell out of it in the lab so that enough of the growth medium would cause the HIV to grow in the lab where there's no immune system so that you could finally see it and say, ah, HIV. It took him 15 times, supposedly, of doing this procedure, very laborious, to finally say, I got an HIV virus. So it's not a plentiful virus we're talking about. And normally to cause disease, you need lots of germs. Furthermore, HIV is like herpes in the sense that once you get the germ, you've always got it, but it goes into a dormant state. So simply because you've managed to, you know, find a remote HIV virus in a human cell does not necessarily mean that this virus is a problem. It could be as dormant as a dormant herpes cell virus. And so there's no proof that it's, you know, causing disease, or that if it does cause disease, it's lethal, or any of those things. Now, one of the most amazing things that people never believe, but I never get tired of saying it because it's kind of cute, is what does it mean if you have antibodies to HIV? Let's, you know, really look at that. I mean, people are saying that's a death sentence. But if they ever come up with an HIV vaccine, you know what that's going to do? It's going to give you antibodies to HIV. And then they're going to say, you're immune, my son. Go forth into the world and live. And anytime you get an HIV test, just tell them that you had the vaccine so they'll know that when you're HIV positive, it's not you're going to die, it means you're immune. Now, nobody really believes that because they say, well, they can't be that crazy. But in fact, that's what we're talking about. So, what's going on here? On the one hand, they say, well, you're dead. You've got antibodies to HIV. Well, you're immune. You've got antibodies to HIV. Nobody's ever answered that question. Now, it is true that in some instances, people who do have antibodies to a specific germ get the disease later on. That's possible. Antibodies don't automatically confer perfect immunity, not necessarily. But traditionally in medicine, I'm talking about orthodox medicine, antibodies means antimicrobial immunity, means you're immune. You fought the battle, the antibodies are there, you're now immune, and if you ever get that germ again, the antibodies say, oh yeah, I know that one, zoop, and you know, you're fine. That's the reasoning in orthodox medical research. It's not always true, but you see what they're saying here is that in every single case of somebody who's antibody positive to HIV, they're going to get AIDS and they're going to die. I mean, that's really the bottom line. Now, to make that kind of incredible statement, you better be rolling up some unbelievable proof that this is a complete contradiction to the usual sort that we've been practicing all these years. If you're going to make that kind of unbelievable death sentence, and they're not doing that. They're not offering the proof. Okay. Now, some people will say, look, we've got correlation here. We know something to do with HIV, even if you're going to call it antibodies, and people who get AIDS. And remember, with cigarettes and cancer, this one is always, we didn't know how cigarettes caused cancer. All we knew is if you smoke, you get cancer. It's a correlation. Not true. We do know some of the mechanisms by which tobacco, nicotine, whatever, the tars, all that business, actually creates cancer. So it's not just a correlation. You need more than correlation. You need causation. Okay. Now, I love this one because here's the Petri dish experiment. And you see, HIV kills T cells, therefore it causes AIDS. Well, here's another Petri dish experiment by a guy named Joachim Buch at the Sloan Kettering Institute, which is a big-time cancer institute. He says that in a Petri dish, and he gives demonstrations, that when vitamin A drops below a certain level, T and B cells commit suicide. So one could, if he were a Martian, not understanding the strange rules by which this whole operation is governed, say, well, tell me, why did you decide to HIV kills T cells in a Petri dish, so why did you decide to spend billions of dollars looking for that virus rather than a few million dollars checking into the vitamin A thesis? Because, I mean, if vitamin A really, you could just give people vitamin A. But that wasn't the way it went. There's obvious reason for that, because there's no money in going in that direction. There's no fame, there's no Nobel Prize, there's no nothing. Okay. Now, there's a guy named Ed McCabe who's written a book called Oxygen Therapies. I talked to him a few times. And he's made the statement that he's interviewed on the QT, doctors who use various kinds of oxygen and ozone medically, who will not speak their names because they know they'll be busted and their licenses taken away. And he's counted up their reports, and they are 300 complete AIDS remissions among these doctors. I said, well, have any of them said they followed up any of these people? He said, yeah, one guy has followed up 100 of his patients for 5 years, and they've been symptom-free. But he's been busted, and he's now going to trial. Just reporting that. No money in oxygen, of course, either. There's a local nutritional doctor, I'm told, who's had some success treating AIDS patients. We will mention no names, please, if you happen to know who this is, but I understand that the protocol involves saying, okay, no drugs, no booze, no cigarettes, no sex, promiscuous or at all, I'm not sure, for about 15 days or whatever it is, and, no immunosuppressive habits at your stage, and then we'll start you on some nutritional therapy, has apparently had some good results. Why isn't this studied? Seriously, why not? when you look at it, what are you talking about? You're talking about a lethal disease, supposedly. No cure, no prevention. So a guy says, well, I think I'm going to try something else. You're busted. You're only permitted to wait and die. Take AZT if you want to, which does not cure the disease and has horrendous side effects and so forth. That's all. We're not allowing you to do anything else. As a patient, we'll be, you know, we'll look a little bit the other way if you start buying some weird stuff from a buyer's club, maybe. This nutrition psychologist who got busted, however, the warrant said they were looking for a certain drug that was sold out of a buyer's club, so they may not be being so nice about that anymore. I mean, what is this? You mean talk about attitude? Is this an attitude? You're going to wait and die, or until we tell you we've got the cure. But if you try anything else as a doctor or go somewhere else, we're going to bust you. We'll take your license away, you won't be able to practice, and maybe we'll put you in jail on top of it. Now, you'd think that, you know, we in a humane society, we'd have that kind of response. But no, we don't. And I could tell you another story about a nutritional company that was busted because it turned out that AIDS patients were taking their supplements and reporting that they were getting better. That's it. The nutritional company decided to fund a study, so naive, they thought that they might do something good. They hired a good physician. He ran what looks to be a meticulous study, had great results. Bang. This company, I was told by an employee, is now under a 5-year gag order not to mention their product in the same breath as AIDS. Not to speak of it. I mean, I've never heard anything like that before. I don't know what that means, even. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Now, some HIV advocates will say, look, you're HIV positive, you will get AIDS. Even if you're fine, you know, don't kid yourself and so forth. But if you notice, since the beginning, as people have said, the goalposts have continually been moved back. At first it was 6 months, then it was a year, then it was 2 years. Now it's 10 years. People are saying 14 years. Gallo in one article said it could be 30 years. You know, and his sort of attitude is kind of like, don't ask me about that stuff. It could be 30 years. All right, shut up. You know, it's HIV. It's nothing else. Don't talk to me. I know what it is. I don't want to hear anything about cofactors, other things involved, immune suppression. If you have to wait 30 years to die, just wait and shut up, you know. So what this does to any kind of proof that HIV causes AIDS is it gives you a fabulous out. You know, you can say, well, my brother is HIV positive. He's fine for 8 years. It means nothing. Just wait. He's going to die. On top of that, about 90% of AIDS cases are men. Germs do not typically. So if this one is, if you know, if that is what you're maintaining, you are obligated to explain why. You know, unless you say, again, well, we know it causes AIDS, we just don't know why it's 90% men. But if you don't know why that it causes AIDS, if you don't know that, then you are obligated to explain how come a germ decides 90% of the time to infect men.
In this country,
right, which makes it even worse, because if you go, you know, then you can say, okay, well, we've got this great germ I want to tell you about. See, in America, it infects 90% of men. In Africa, it's 50% men and 50% women. Well, go ahead. We'll talk about it. No, I don't know about that. So let me finish. A germ that behaves in that fashion, where it infects 90% of the men in America, or 90% of men in America, and 10% of women, and 50% men in Africa and 50% women in Africa, if you are an orthodox doctor who's trying to prove that HIV causes AIDS, you are obligated to explain how a germ can do that. not by some biowarfare theory, but by traditional medicine, because those are the jokers who originally said that HIV causes AIDS. They're obligated to prove it. And if you'll notice that the biowarfare theorists will attack Robert Gallo and all of those guys at NIH on everything and call them a bunch of lunatics, except they know that HIV causes AIDS, and those guys discovered it, and they were right about that one. Baloney. Now, could it be that another germ causes AIDS? Why not? Other germs have been found in AIDS patients. There was a researcher in New York who found some adenoviruses, some sort of unusual adenoviruses in the urine of AIDS patients. You didn't need some high-tech thing to find that. It was very clear, easy to see. That research was scrapped. Never heard about that again. There was a guy who did an animal study, Peter Walzer, who found that tetracycline, corticosteroids, and malnutrition caused pneumocystis pneumonia in rats. Now, if you want to go looking at certain people who have what they call risk behavior, you'll see corticosteroids, malnutrition, tetracycline. Suggestive? Ever followed up? Anybody ever hear about it? No. So, we have lots of different possible immunosuppression. Poppers. Huge amounts of poppers. A researcher at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, I believe it's called, Harry Havercoats, told me, he said, the nitrites in poppers give you about several million times the quantity as in bacon. So they're telling us bacon is a little dangerous, shouldn't eat much bacon. What about butyl and isobutyl and amyl nitrites, which in that particular risk group were prevalent? But now, I don't want to say that AIDS is one thing or caused by one thing, because I think that that research question has to be left open. That's another trap. Because obviously, everybody that's diagnosed with AIDS has not been doing poppers. They don't all have syphilis. They're not all immunosuppressed by, bad sanitation, whatever. But the pattern is immune suppression and opportunistic infection. So suppose that globally, all sorts of immune suppression from various causes, some may be microbial, some may be environmental, depending on the risk group, some may be people who reacted extremely badly to vaccinations in the third world for a variety of reasons, because they're already immunosuppressed and you give a vaccine to somebody when they should be getting food instead, you know. And a tremendous collapse can occur in people, and they can die, and it can look like AIDS, or what they're calling AIDS. And if you give that one name, you end up with a worldwide disease that needs billions of dollars to cure it, and you're looking for a vaccine and a drug, and it's a big business. And if you say it's many different types of immune suppression, and ultimately the doctor has to look at that patient that's there and determine what's suppressing his immune system and not just say we're looking for HIV, you don't have a profitable pharmaceutical solution here. You've got a lot of doctors operating on their own, and we can't have that. We're going to bust those doctors, because we want to keep them in line, because we want to introduce a pharmaceutical solution that people are going to use. We don't want to hear stories about vitamin A and about nutritional supplements and about oxygen therapies and about the cheap stuff. Now, some HIV advocates say that HIV must cause AIDS because so many scientists think so, and how could they all be wrong? That is a major argument that I have gotten whenever I've been on the radio and so forth. Are you kidding? They all couldn't be crazy, you know. But you have to understand that there, as I said, there was no more research into the cause of AIDS as soon as the announcement was made in 1984. Boom, that stopped. End of question. To get grants, you had to say HIV caused AIDS. Now, there was a press conference in New York. As soon as Gallo announced it, they sent up slides for the reporters, you know, and somebody said, now look at the thing, you see, here's the French version of HIV and here's the American version. They worked on it, we got it, we discovered it, we announced it, the French are suing the Americans, you know, saying you stole our virus. But we want to show you what this virus is all about. And they lined up the two specimens. And this guy that I know, Joe Sonnabend, this doctor, he's sitting there and he's looking at these two specimens. They're exactly the same. They're exactly the same, which is impossible because this germ mutates. And if you have two specimens that are exactly the same, it's the same specimen. In other words, either through some fabulous, you know, clerical error or... much deeper problem being expressed here. The virus was stolen from the French, and it was sort of like the French said, check this out, we think it might have something useful. Oh, thanks a lot. This is the cause of AIDS. Now, people attack Robert Gallo for that kind of thing, but what they forget is, if that story is truly true, then what kind of research are we talking about? Research to determine what caused AIDS. We're talking about this much research, which may explain why there are so many discrepancies and contradictions and unresolved questions. So everyone that assumes, you know, they've got a great theory about what AIDS really is and it's all based on HIV, better wake up and check it out. Now, some scientists have a financial stake in saying that HIV causes AIDS. William Hazeltine, Max Essex, two Boston researchers formerly at Harvard. Robin Weiss, major British researcher. Robert Gallo, the major researcher in the world, are all making money off the antibody test kits. They are linked up with corporations, or they have patents, or whatever it is. So for them, they have a conflict of interest. They should be drummed out of the court tomorrow. I don't care if it's against the law or what. They should be gone, because this is supposed to be an area where you're above that sort of thing. And if you're not, it should be out the window. No questions asked. We're not going to take you to court to try to prove that you're a fake. All we're going to establish is you've got a conflict of interest. Pete Rose bet on baseball. We don't care if he threw games. It expresses a conflict of interest. You're out of the game for life. You know, you can apply in 2 years. Maybe we'll let you in the Hall of Fame. So say to Robert Gallo, you're out. You know, maybe we'll let you back in and maybe we'll give you a prize later on. Now, the system of grants has changed in one other way, and I was told this by Bernard Forscher, who used to work at the Mayo Clinic, got sick of the whole thing. I don't know, it wasn't the Mayo Clinic exactly he got sick of, but the system is what he got sick of, and he left in 1962. And he said, look, it used to be a guy taught at a university. He made a salary. He was a professor. He was, you know, secure. And then on top of that, he got some grant money, and he did research later on in the day. And the grant money might come, it might go, but he had a backup, and so he could be completely ethical about what he was doing. But gradually that system changed because the money got bigger, and eventually you would have people doing research associated with universities who didn't teach anybody anything. I said, what? You mean the guys at Harvard and that kind of, they have researchers that don't teach? He said, yeah, they don't teach. They do research. They're on big grants, and the university sometimes lops 50% off the top for itself. And then the primary researcher with his little empire kind of is responsible for where the rest of the money goes.
70 for MIT.
Thank you, 70 for MIT. Okay, so we're talking about a different ball game here, because if you build an empire based on grant money, you've got to get the grant money rolling in. And if you say, you know, I think HIV doesn't cause AIDS, it's a bunch of crap. What happens to the house and the kids and the car and the wife and thing and whatever? You know, the empire, the lab, the job. So I'm going to short circuit some of the rest of this and say, could there be a different model of AIDS? Yes. One possibility would be exactly as I said, a number of different immunosuppressive conditions lumped under one rubric. We call it AIDS. It's not. It's immune suppression in various forms, some caused by germs, possibly some caused by chemical, whatever. You know, you have to look at the situation. Now, AIDS in Africa, a lot of people are total experts about AIDS in Africa, never been there, don't know anyone who has. They know all about it. They know that there are 75 million people dying in Africa of AIDS. They know all of these things, and they know that it has to do with, you know, contaminated vaccines. They know everything. So I started from this idea. Let's just take an AIDS country and see what I can find out about it without going over there because I don't have the money. Let me just talk to people. Uganda is supposed to have been the hotbed of AIDS when I wrote about it in 1988. So I started talking to people. A few Ugandans who were at the UN, the World Bank, whatever, scientists, diplomats, none of them would talk on the record. Strange. I spoke with an American researcher who had been there for a summer. I spoke to a couple of other people who had been there. They said, there's a lot of stuff going on over there. First of all, the HIV testing is horrible. 40% false positives. They don't know what the hell they're doing. In fact, the whole health system's broken down since Idi Amin, so nobody's doing postmortems on anybody's dying from any disease about anything. So they don't know what they're talking about anything, really. But, of course, they're reporting all kinds of incredible HIV figures out of Uganda. There seems to be some malnutrition in some areas, people coming into health clinics, getting weighed. Other places, they don't seem to have a problem with it. There's a lot of food. There's a new disease caused by ticks along a highway out of Kampala where they used to drive, but now it's got so many potholes in it, you have to walk 20 miles on this road, and there's a lot of ticks, and they're infested and infected with whatever parasites. New disease has popped up. People are not reacting well to this. They have something called ulcerated chancroid over there, extremely debilitating. Some people say a third of the adult male population has it. There is a lake there that had all kinds of fish in it. It's totally dead now. Nobody knows why. It's in a region where they're reporting AIDS. There are pigs running around that have African swine fever. Which has been found in humans in New York City, even AIDS patients, even though it's not supposed to infect humans. And the Department of Agriculture will tell you until the end of time that it does not affect humans. But there are test results confirmed by the New York City Department of Health that, yes, they found this. What does that mean? There's these pigs that are found out in the open. There's some sanitation problems in places. They have a disease called brucellosis from cows, which they've imported, started new dairy farms. These cows can transmit disease to humans who are ending up in the hospital, and researchers are saying, you know, there's a new disease called brucellosis, and nobody really knows about it. They're misdiagnosing people all over the place. What are the symptoms? Same symptoms as SLIM, which is what they're calling African AIDS. Oh, yeah? Well, let's see. What does this mean, you know? What else is happening over there? People are dosing themselves with antibiotics like chloramphenicol, very strong antibiotics, some of them could be getting sick from that. There's all kinds of things happening, plus the traditional diseases like diarrhea, which is supposed to be a major symptom of SLIM. People are coming into hospitals over a period of 30 years. They've kept statistics on 30,000 people coming into one hospital in Uganda. And something like, you know, let's take a figure like 17% of the people have this bad diarrhea. SLIM, one of the main, you know, things about SLIM is diarrhea. This is a new disease over there? Well, maybe it's a lot of things over there. So I went back to the paper that this guy Sirwada wrote in 1985 in Lancet to try to discover SLIM. You know, this was like, hey, we've got African AIDS. Let me describe it for you. Okay, so what are the symptoms? The symptoms are abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea, weakness, fatigue, and so forth and whatever. And he says at the end of the paper, he says, typically the people that, you know, you'll find who develop this first go through a period of some malaise, and then they dose themselves with with drugs like chloramphenicol and chloroquine and so forth. And so I go to the physician's desk reference and I look up those drugs, and what are the side effects of those drugs? The symptoms of SLIM that he's talking about. The onset symptoms of SLIM. This guy's got to be, you know, a fabulous researcher. I mean, did it ever occur to him to think about that? Does that give you pause for thought about how good his research was altogether? So the question about, you know, yeah, we know what's happening in Africa. Everybody's dying of AIDS, and it's all biowarfare, and they're killing or whatever, or whatever it is. Baloney! People don't know what's happening in Africa. They do not know what's happening. A lot of things are happening in Africa. And this is what people want. People want, you know, the myth of the conspiracy with the one thing, the devil is killing everybody, and now I understand, and now I feel good, because now I know why everything is so horrible, because that's why, you know. Well, maybe that's true. I mean, maybe there is, you know, a big cheese up at the top that's ruining everybody's lives. However, maybe not all the time. And maybe this is an instance where it isn't one of those things. Maybe this is an instance where someone has actually created one image of AIDS when it's not one thing. Okay. And if we had more researchers who knew what they were doing, we could start to ask these questions in an open atmosphere. And the biowarfare people and whoever they are, and the hepatitis B vaccine people and the smallpox vaccine people, everybody gets into the act. Let's see your research. Let's see the journal papers. Spread it out there. You can't get it published? We don't care. We'll look at it. Let's see what's going on. Open up the whole thing again. Let's find out what the hell's happening, why all these people are dying. It's real. It's not, you know, some people say, well, you're trying to say it doesn't exist. It's a lot of crap. Of course it exists, but what exists is the question. And that is open to debate, but there is no debate. So how much time do we have now? 3 minutes. Okay, kill me.
You haven't said a word about IG Farben.
No, I haven't said a word about IG Farben. What do you want me to say about it?
A lot.
Well, I don't have anything to say about IG Farben.
That's terrible.
Well?
How about human herpes virus number 6?
Okay.
How about human herpes virus number 6? I understand that's included now in chronic fatigue syndrome.
Right.
And
some people, that's another theory that maybe...
Supposedly that have it also die much quicker.
Some people say that, but as far as I know, that has not really been established, but it's a theory, yes. Yes.
I have a few brief questions. Bertrand Russell published a book in the early 50s, 52. I think it was called Limit to Growth, and there he says that the wars being too dangerous now and with the nukes present, probably biological agents would be the agent of choice in future population reduction campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. What do you think about that? Number two,
can't prove that this is what's happening.
Congressional document of 69, the appropriation committee that voted $10 million for an immunodepressive agent. What do you think about that?
Okay, I'll tell you about that.
And one more brief question. And number three, further research in biological warfare for population control in AIDS, which is the malathion, and the beam down AIDS, which is these radar, ground penetrating radar, and other extremely powerful radar emission satellites that have other frequencies and experiments piggyback on what is actually given to the press. Radio frequential immunology.
I understand
and
what you're saying.
Immune depression through radio frequencies have been the research for the last 20 years. Basically,
okay.
AIDS is the research.
Hold it. You gave me three long questions here. I'm not ruling out any of this stuff, but you see, where everybody goes crazy is, it's sort of like, here's the list of all possible immunosuppression. Pick one and decide which one you think is really causing AIDS. And what I'm saying is, open it up. If somebody can prove that somebody's doing depopulation with microbial agents now, not in 1969. I mean, I got some things to say about that. I know about that hearing. Let's see it. But even if that were true, I mean, even if that were so, that still doesn't necessarily explain this whole phenomenon called AIDS, because it could very well be that there are still a number of things happening. Yes, let's suppose we've got people living next to these huge power lines and they're having immunosuppressive problems. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. I'm not an expert on that. Maybe we have forms of chemical warfare through tremendous pesticides and, you know, all of that stuff. We certainly do have a lot of pesticide dumping in the third world. I talk about it in my book, and I talk about other chemical problems that cause immune suppression and pharmaceuticals that can do that. So we're going to wind up the tape portion of this now as if in reality we are quitting, you see, and we're going to pretend that this is the end, but in actuality we're going to have a few more minutes of questions so they can get the tape off, okay? Good night, but hello. So let me just finish.